The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Oh, good evening. I'd like to welcome you all here, and I've been asked to remind you to turn off your cell phones and to refrain from taking any photographs. I'm Dr. Jen Wagner. I'm an Egyptologist at the Penn Museum here in Philadelphia, and at Penn, I'm also an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, and in that role, I spend a lot of time thinking about Cleopatra and the period in which she lived. I teach a class there at Penn called The World of Cleopatra, which is really just a sexy title for a Ptolemaic history class. So even Egyptologists are guilty of, you know, using Cleopatra to sell stuff. But a good part of that class is spent examining the image of Cleopatra VII. And I think we all have an idea in our minds of Cleopatra, what she looked like, what she did, what she was all about. We've all seen representations of Cleopatra, and even those as early as the Middle Ages feature a lot of exposed skin, luxurious surroundings, and questionable interactions with serpents. So it does sound a little bit wild. And of course, we know that Hollywood has done a great job of portraying Cleopatra for us. And Cleopatra is a woman who's been called someone who has had insatiable sexual appetites. But she seems to have been really more of a serial monogamist. We know of only two men by name with whom she was involved, and the second only after the death of the first. She's been called a fatal beauty, but depictions of her on coins don't exactly resemble Elizabeth Taylor. And even the ancient writer Plutarch hints that she may have had a nice personality rather than a dazzling beauty. And Plutarch's work, The Life of Anthony, is probably our most important source on Cleopatra, on her life. And Plutarch's descriptions of her hint at what may have been her real power. It's her conversation, it's her mind, it's her intellect that seems to have been her real attraction and the source of her influence. Now, she's been called bloodthirsty and cruel, and it's true, she did have people killed, including a number of family members. But this was in keeping with good Ptolemaic tradition. They were a remarkably murderous and awful dynasty. She does seem to have been a political mastermind. She's been called power-crazed. But what's clear is that she's determined to protect her country, Egypt, from Roman occupation. And she's one of only a handful of women to rule Egypt on her own. Hatshepsut is probably our other most famous example, and she's about 1,400 years before the time of Cleopatra. Now, there are ancient sources that describe her, but what we have to keep in mind is that most of these sources were very critical of her, and most of the writers were sympathetic to Rome and thought of her as public enemy number one. And these writers hurl all kinds of accusations at her. And now we have to keep in mind, she's a woman, she's very powerful, and those two elements combine with the fact that Romans had a prejudice against the East and what they viewed as its debauched nature, kind of made Cleopatra the very public face for everything that Rome despised. Equally problematic is that, archaeologically speaking, we have very little evidence with which to complete our understanding of Cleopatra. Much of the ancient city of Alexandria, where Cleopatra lived and died, has either been built over or is at the bottom of the Mediterranean. So now, to help us understand this formidable woman a bit more, we have this wonderful new biography of Cleopatra by our guest of honor tonight, Stacy Schiff, who has gone through the historical sources, combed through the modern scholarship, to give us a new portrayal of Cleopatra VII. She's given us a wonderfully researched book that's a pleasure to read, and I can't wait to use it in my class. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacy Schiff, who will speak to us on Cleopatra, that most fascinating of women.
Thank you. A few years ago, a very wise writer defined biography as the revenge of the little people on the big people. And as subjects go, they don't get bigger than Cleopatra. She belongs to that exclusive club of historical figures whose names we all recognize, even though we know next to nothing about them. Few women rival her in either history or in legend. Think Delilah meets Catherine the Great meets Jackie O. Here is the ultimate collision of women in power, a brew of sex and celebrity. On the other hand, what we do know about Cleopatra, as you just heard, is twisted beyond all recognition. And the record is scanty, to say the least, about which more in a minute. I should say that on the paucity of material scale, I consoled myself over the last 5 years with the fact that Cleopatra has better materials than Shakespeare, if worse materials than Jane Austen, about whom people write every year. Let me say at the outset that I wasn't sure that this book could even be written. From the biographer's point of view, Cleopatra is something of a Mount Everest. I had the idea in mind for years, but I couldn't see a way to write anything resembling a traditional narrative of her life. Cleopatra turns out to have been on the list, every list I made of potential subjects since 1999, something I only discovered in retrospect. At the time, the idea struck me less as biography than paleontology. It was bringing statues to life, really. We may live in the post-factual age, as someone recently said, but Cleopatra lived in the pre-factual age. There is almost nothing by way of ancient statistics, for example. So can you rescue a person who was dissolved into a puddle of myth and misconception? This was particularly problematic for me because I was used to knowing, as a biographer, what my subject had had for dinner and worried about before he fell asleep at night and what he woke up dreaming about. I can tell you what Nabokov's wife put on his shopping list and which cheeses Ben Franklin ordered for his household. And here, all bets were off. The Nile is not even where it once was. It's 2 miles farther east. The geography of Alexandria has changed. The city is flatter than it once was. Almost everything has changed. The language, the culture, the religion, the calendar. Don't even ask about the prices. You have to get used to, I mean, converting from ancient prices to modern prices, it's a useless exercise. You have to get used to counting backward. Cleopatra was born in 69 and she dies in 30 BC. And you essentially check all preconceptions at the door when you enter the world of her dynasty, the Ptolemies. How, for example, do you write about maternity in a family where children routinely poison their parents and parents dismember their children? Over and over, mothers sent troops against their sons, sisters waged war against brothers, and hacked apart their sisters. But let me put those little peccadilloes in context. And you have to suffer through this part because you're in Philadelphia. I was coming to this project from 5 years with Benjamin Franklin. And I had been writing about his years in France, which are essentially the 8 years in which the American Revolution takes place and the peace is signed afterwards. For those years, the American documentation alone is 2.5 times greater than it is for the rest of Benjamin Franklin's life combined. And that's not counting the French materials. In Paris, Franklin was surrounded by a net of British spies who were surrounded by a net of French spies. And as far as I can tell, each one of those men was paid by the word. I'm not kidding. Nothing was too trivial to be reported on, including Franklin's breakfast menu and the state of his laundry, which I'm happy to say was invariably impeccable. Everyone who owned a pen wrote a memoir in the 18th century, and those who didn't appeared to own a newspaper. There were both official French newspapers and unofficial French newspapers, the reports of which reliably contradicted each other. I might add that John Adams, also in Paris at the time, appears to have owned several pens, missed his wife dreadfully, and had very little else to do but write about Benjamin Franklin, but that's another story. And that book is upstairs, too, by the way. So what do you look for in a biographical subject anyway? Why did Cleopatra sit on that list since 1999? Surely some kind of resonance between subject and author is necessary. After all, it is a kind of collaboration, even if it's not a collaboration of two willing parties. There has to be something instinctively right about it. Sometimes you just know you can't marry a man who collects tiny military figurines, and sometimes you know you can't write about a particular subject. You're just not willing to be blind for 5 years with Milton, or depressed with Carlyle, or neurotic with Florence Nightingale. And you hope to be able to approach your temporary alter ego with the intimacy of a lover, the even-handedness of a judge, the awe of a child. The people we all know, and those with whom we live, though of course neither you nor I, do all kinds of senseless and contradictory and counterproductive things. They make the same mistakes twice. But you, the biographer, are meant to be clear-sighted, impartial, and unforgiving. You're meant to notice when, for example, a man writes the same letter to his mistress that he had written to his wife 13 years earlier. This is an especially unattractive quality in anyone, but particularly in someone who will go on to establish a reputation as the century's most inventive and most original prose stylist, and whose name is Nabokov. Who then would be the ideal biographical subject? He or she would have lived after the advent of photography. He would have been the star of his penmanship class at grade school. He would thereafter write in English that positively sings. There was a lot of Lafayette, for example, that did not end up in my Franklin book for the simple reason that I could not read Lafayette's handwriting. And my only consolation on this one was I once complained to the great historian Peter Gay about this problem I was having deciphering Lafayette. And he said consolingly, "Don't you know Gay's law of history? If you can't read it, it didn't happen." It's a supreme advantage to have a quotable subject, or at least it is to a point. I do pity the Oscar Wilde biographer. Writing about Oscar Wilde seems to me like walking down the street behind a supermodel. I mean, there's no way you can say anything that gets anyone's attention. The subject's papers should be accessible, but not too accessible, and within a three-hour drive of your front door. Some of them should ideally have materialized from a mold-proof attic months after you've begun your work. I should say, too, that it's an advantage if your subject lived under an authoritarian government. Repressive regimes keep the best archives. You want him to have had friends and confidants, all of them with photographic memories, all of them still walking around, but who have not already talked to 15 other biographers. You don't want the recycled stories. And those associates should not be legion. In other words, you don't want to interview every member of the 1969 NASA team. You want someone whose name rings immediate bells, but who's not overly familiar, of whom we've all heard, but of whom we know nothing. And you're not Bob Woodward. Investigative journalism is not your forte. Oh, you also want someone who died young, like Mozart or Keats or Pocahontas or Cleopatra. And then once you've satisfied all of those rational criteria, you realize with a pang that you want something else too, something much more important in this person with whom you're about to spend 5 or 10 or 15 years. You want to like him or her too. Why Cleopatra then? Or put another way, why would a relatively experienced, predominantly sane biographer who reads neither Greek nor Latin and who is happiest in a dusty archive attempt a biography of a first century BC queen of whom no shred of documentation remains? Perhaps most of all, I was startled by my own ignorance. Here was a woman whom we think of as Egyptian, but who was in fact Greek, whom we remember as beautiful, but who was, even in the classical accounts, as you just heard, more notable for her charm and her intelligence than for her looks. Here was a woman whom we have somehow conflated with Nefertiti, a queen who had lived 1,300 years earlier. Here was a woman who successfully rules a rich and fractious country for over 2 decades. She's the only woman of antiquity to rule alone, steering Egypt through plague and war and famine, but whom we have reduced to a seductress and a siren and a snare. And then there was the enormity of her position. Every bit of Egypt belongs to Cleopatra, from the wheat fields to the oil presses to the crocodiles in the Nile itself. Every person in Egypt works for her. She profits from anything grown or sold in her kingdom. The end result of this is a treasury unmatched by any other sovereign. She was hands down the richest person, man or woman, in the Mediterranean. Hers was an astronomical fortune by Roman standards, and remember that everything we know about Cleopatra comes to us from Rome or from Roman officials. By those standards, even the eunuchs who wait on her are rich. Her palace was the most sumptuous in existence, all onyx and ebony, with gold ceilings and gem-studded walls. It left every ancient commentator at a loss for words, or so he would say, and then he would usually go on for 30 pages on the subject. It's difficult to convey how all of that struck a Roman, since the Rome we imagine, the monumental Rome of the Pantheon, the Colosseum, did not yet exist. In Cleopatra's lifetime, Alexandria was still the center of the world, the fashion capital, and the seat of civilization. Hers was the city of automatic doors and coin-operated machines. It was a city in which subjects which would be discussed, which would be forgotten for another 1,500 years, lightning conductors, the value of pi, the idea that the earth was round, the latitude of Marseille. By comparison, Rome was a provincial backwater. Cleopatra travels from one to the other, from Alexandria to Rome in 46 to join Caesar. And in the book, I've compared the two cities, or that trip, to traveling from Paris of the 18th century to 18th century Philadelphia. Forgive me. Even stranger to Rome, gender mattered less than competence in Cleopatra's Egypt, where women operated mills and leased vineyards, divorced husbands, inherited equally, and essentially enjoyed rights that they would not regain for another 2,000 years. Arguably, Cleopatra had more female role models than any queen in history. And she had an education every bit on par with that of Caesar. She knew her Homer, her Aeschylus, her Euripides. She had studied with the best tutors of the day. She essentially had been to the same elite institution of higher learning. And unlike Caesar, she spoke 9 languages. Now, as you already know, poisoning and assassinating siblings were Cleopatra's family's specialties. She was the second of 5 siblings, born of parents who probably were brother and sister. Just to make the family tree perfectly clear, her great-grandfather was her great-grandfather 3 times over. He was also her great-great-grandfather 2x. Don't ask. In any event, there were 5 siblings. Her father, Auletes, leaves town when Cleopatra's eldest sister is a teenager, and she promptly usurps the throne. He has her murdered on his return. Cleopatra is 13 or 14 at this point, and she's next in line for the throne. On her father's death, she and her next youngest brother ascend to the throne together. He's 10. They are soon engaged in a civil war. He will die in that contest, which leaves Cleopatra at 22 with 2 surviving siblings. By this time, Caesar has arrived on the scene, and he conveniently exiles the remaining sister to modern-day Turkey. Within 2 years, Cleopatra will poison her brother. Later, as a favor to her, Mark Antony will arrange for the sister's murder. In other words, none of Cleopatra's siblings survives past the age of 20. She's the only one who will die on her own terms. Also, in other words, she gets very powerful Romans to do her bidding. I think I forgot to mention that both of those brothers were her titular husbands at the time that they died, but I think I have now addressed the question of Cleopatra's grasp of strategy and her affinity for power. Of course, that brand of savagery was standard operating procedure. As Plutarch reminds us, it happened in the best of families. Monarchy was, as he gracefully put it, an utterly unsociable thing. Had Cleopatra not murdered her siblings, they would have murdered her. And the fact that she's still alive at 21 when she meets Caesar in Alexandria is testament, in fact, to her cleverness. And just to put that meeting in perspective for a minute, if you've seen paintings of it, or if you remember your Elizabeth Taylor, you know that Cleopatra leapt out of a roll of carpet before Caesar, kind of the original girl in a cake. But if you pull the camera back a little, you'll see several other pieces of the picture. First of all, it wasn't a roll of carpet, but it was a traveler's sack made out of some sort of heavy fabric like canvas. And second of all, Cleopatra had had herself smuggled into the palace out of necessity rather than for special effect. Her brother, this is the brother with whom she's fighting a civil war, was in control of the city, and both she and Caesar were at war with him. Her life was at stake. The palace was surrounded by barricades. She appeared before Caesar to plead for her throne rather than to seduce him. 9 months later, she had both her kingdom and his child. You can draw whatever conclusions you like about her methods. Someone asked me recently, when I realized that this book could actually be written, and I answered glibly but not inaccurately that I realized it could be written when I finished writing it. But there was one other moment in truth. It was when I finally noticed that we had actual 2,000-year-old quotes from Cleopatra, that we could hear just a hint of her voice. And that's, for the most part, thanks to Plutarch. On the one hand, it pays to remember that Plutarch was writing a good century after Cleopatra's death. He is as far removed from her as we are from Ulysses Grant. On the other hand, as a modern biographer recently pointed out to me, there were no tape recorders in the 19th century either. It goes without saying that quoted material is always approximate. And two, as I had learned from Ben Franklin, even the most comprehensive archives can refuse to divulge answers. From hundreds of linear feet of documentation, the inner life may still go missing. And documentation is not the same as revelation, any more than information is the same as wisdom, or accuracy the same as truth. 5 years in those miles and miles of papers, and I still can't tell you who the mother of Ben Franklin's son was. I doubt anyone ever will. I knew there were questions that could never be answered with Cleopatra, but I also knew that that had nothing to do with the millennia that separate us from her. What went on between Virginia Woolf and her brother? How did Shelley die? What was Emily Dickinson's problem? Where is Jimmy Hoffa? None of these questions have answers either. And in some cases, in fact, it's because we have an overload of information. Too many accounts can spoil the truth. How then was it possible to write about Cleopatra? Let me go back to that dialogue in Plutarch for a minute. It comes in a marvelous account of Cleopatra and Mark Antony out fishing on one sunny and carefree Alexandrian afternoon. Plutarch meant to use the incident to illustrate what he calls Antony's boyish pranks, but it offers something else as well. The most accomplished military commander of the day, Antony is unable to lure a single fish from the fertile waters of Egypt. This is embarrassing. It's always worse when you have your girlfriend, the Queen of Egypt, at your side. And so he arranges for one of his servants to dive under the water. Wouldn't you do this too? And attach several pre-caught fish to his fishing line. And these he triumphantly reels in one after another. The scam is not lost on Cleopatra. She's very competitive by nature, and she has an impish sense of humor. So she arranges for all of their friends to come watch her highly skilled Roman friend the next day, when she also sees to it that one of her servants attaches an imported salted herring to Antony's line. This he pulls out of Egypt's waters to peals of laughter. On the spot, she advises him to forget about fishing. It's not his real sport. He should attend to his real responsibilities. He's meant to be out hunting for cities, kingdoms, and continents. She's sly and she's saucy, but there's also something familiar in her tone. It's that tone that every woman whose husband owns a set of golf clubs knows well. I should say, too, that the holes in the story are, as always, very telling and often as revealing as the information they elide. Cleopatra, for example, is in Rome when Caesar is murdered. She's staying in his villa with their child. It was in no Roman historian's best interest to expound on that relationship, which is conducted with no great discretion while Caesar's wife lives across town. And after Caesar's death, he's deified. Definitely no place for an Egyptian queen in that story. So there are two full chapters in this book about Cleopatra in Rome, both of them spun out of three lines of Cicero. Think of it then as deductive more than inductive reasoning. I was moving from the very great deal we knew about Cleopatra's world to what that meant for one highly educated, clever woman ruling at an unstable time, sitting at an all-male table, and on two occasions, in fact, living in an all-male military camp. So yes, there were terrific constraints. Did I miss the eyewitnesses, the documents, the portraits, the relics, the fairy dust? You bet I did. I really miss the typewriters. From the biographer's point of view, civilization begins with the advent of the typewriter and ends with the advent of email. And it was very lonely out there with just Plutarch, Suetonius, and Elizabeth Taylor. At the same time, great literature is about ambiguity, and it seemed to me that biography could afford to be at times as well. You can't demand order or even answers of the classical world Arguably, you rarely can even when it comes to the human heart. But you can do a lot with Cleopatra's world, especially given the last 50 years of fine scholarship that's been devoted to it. Virginia Woolf once remarked of an imperfect novel that the string didn't quite unite the pearls, but that the pearls were there. And I took that as a sort of operating premise here. There's also in my mind was Julian Barnes's wonderful alternate definition of a net, which is a series of holes tied together by string. So there were huge unknowns, but there were also known knowns, among them several critical things that I thought no one had really explored before, like Cleopatra's education or the extent of her wealth. Years ago, I interviewed David Herbert Donald, the great Lincoln biographer, and I asked him about his scholarship. He worked, after all, in one of the most closely mined fields in American history. Stacy, he said to me at one point, there are never any new answers. There are only new questions. And of course, I had one terrific advantage. Human nature is remarkably constant. It has changed not one iota since the first century BC. You can read Cicero on how not to spoil a rich child. A friend of one's friend was already one's enemy. Power was already an aphrodisiac. You can read countless texts on how women are shrill and unbending in their demands but loose in their morals. Wives came in precisely two varieties. There was the scheming spendthrift wife for whom no house is large enough and no diamond big enough. And then there was the paragon of virtue who, and I quote, loved her husband, bore two sons, kept the house, and worked in wool. That's me. Every problem Cleopatra had with Rome is the problem that a woman in power faces today with very little variation if arguably better birth control. The successful woman is sexualized, shrill, and unnatural. And when a woman sleeps with two of the most powerful men of her day, she is a seductress, even if both of those men happen to be celebrated for their voracious sexual appetites. How we constitute and reconstitute history, then, was on my mind all the way through as I wrote this one. There's, of course, a central problem always in writing history. Those closest to events have the best information, but also the most at stake. The most informed source is, by definition, the most involved source. The later chroniclers may know more, but they can may know less, but they can say more. With each book, I've been well into the work, but before I realized that there was something utterly rudimentary I had forgotten to research. With the Franklin book, it was the American Revolution. I was writing from the French side, in all fairness. I kept forgetting that it took place in America. In this case, it was that I needed to understand precisely who the men who left us Cleopatra's story were. I had ventured out to the desert where Cleopatra was exiled. I had soaked in all the Alexandrian color before I realized that I needed to know my sources as well as I knew my subject. Of those who actually knew Cleopatra, and who wrote about her, there are only three. Caesar, who was married to someone else during his affair with her, focused on Rome and understandably reluctant to mention her. Nicholas of Damascus, who'd been the tutor to her children and who changed sides after her death to become a close confidant of her sworn enemy, Herod. And Cicero, the statesman and the great orator, who rarely had a kind word for anyone. I loved that about him. He had vexed relationships with women. He prided himself on his books. He found Egypt to be suspect. He liked to be the quickest-witted person in the room. And intelligent women who had better libraries than he did offended him on three counts. I tried to keep an eye throughout the writing on who was a sensationalist and who was a scold, who had set eyes on Egypt and who simply despised the place. Nearly all the men who write about Cleopatra are Romans and officers of that empire. Many instinctively hailed from the school of Euripides, who perhaps put it best, he writes, if only women were nowhere to be found except in my lap. So I've tried to work the commentators and their personalities and their biases into the book while focusing primarily on the narrative. The object was to tell a fast-paced story, leaving the necessary blanks blank, but slaloming a little bit across the wake of the legend. From the French newspapers of Franklin's day, I knew the difference between propaganda and hearsay. And in Cleopatra's case, we owe a great debt to both. Biased and inaccurate, though they may have been, the Romans who left us her story did us a tremendous favor. Normally, women are very difficult to write about. They keep lousy records, and their lives go undocumented. Cleopatra owes her immortality to her enemies. She's one of the few women in history whose detractors have enlarged rather than erased her role. Had she been a man, she would have been forgotten today, like so many of the other Eastern sovereigns whom Rome eliminates. And for that record, for that point, had Rome not intervened, had Cleopatra been dealt a stronger hand, she would have faced a different but no less vicious enemy. In the normal course of events, she would ultimately have been deposed, poisoned, exiled, or hacked to pieces by one of her own four children. In which case, do you know what? We would never have heard of her at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that presentation, Stacy. My name is Andy. I'm the director of author events here. Welcome to all of you. And the way this works is you raise your hand, I'll call on you, we'll get a microphone to you, and who would like to start us off? Right here in the third aisle, the gentleman.
You talked about the difficulties of being a biographer looking back to Cleopatra. Imagine yourself being a biographer in the year 100 years from now, looking back now. Would your task be more difficult because people are using emails and there are far fewer records than there were even about Cleopatra?
It's a wonderful question. I think every biographer or historian today lives with a great fantasy, which is that somewhere in the sky there's this enormous server holding all email, and that it will somehow be able to be accessed in the future. So that whenever anyone gets in trouble in a corporate environment, have you noticed all the emails suddenly appear? So why can't that happen for an historian, just as well as it happens for the due diligence people at Goldman Sachs? I mean, it seems to me as if that should be fair. But yes is the answer to your question. So much of what we do telephonically, if not, or we used to do telephonically, or by text, or by email. A great deal is certainly being lost. And from my point of view, now there is this, you know, idyllic period where you want to write biography or history, which is, as I say, you know, after the typewriter was invented. I mean, reading 18th century French, handwritten French on microfilm is not my idea of fun. And right up until the advent of email. And, you know, after that, all bets are off.
Another question. One, two, three, fourth row here, the lady.
You've talked a great deal about the written sources that you relied on. Did you rely at all on the material record? That is, the things that were left behind? Was there anything at all that the objects contributed to your writing?
That's a wonderful and frustrating problem. I spent a lot of time in Alexandria, largely because I'm of that school that believes you need to know the geography of what you're writing about. You need to know the color. You need to know where the sun sets, how the tides work, and how the wind blows. After that, there's very little physically left in Alexandria. If you want to see the artifacts of Cleopatra's day, you are better off in the museums of London, Berlin, New York, Philadelphia. I mean, you're better off in a museum context. There was in Alexandria a fabulous Greco-Roman museum, which had a lot of that period, which has been closed for renovations, and I think its collection is going to be dispersed, in fact. I'm not sure it will ever reopen. But that very thin period of Greek Alexandrian history has almost entirely disappeared in Alexandria. You can still see Roman Alexandria. The Greek part is very, very hard to see. A few of those things you can obviously now see at the Franklin Institute because they've been part of the Gaudio excavations. There's very little left. What we do have, though, we have in terms of jewelry or mosaics, objects, it's sumptuous beyond belief. So that it's very easy to believe those classical writers who say, you know, the golden goblet encrusted with jewels, or, you know, the amazing ornaments that Cleopatra had. It's very easy to be able to see the kind of splendor they were talking about, but those pieces are few and far between.
Another question, lady on our left.
Did she kill herself with a snake?
I'm so glad you asked. How long do I have? We have two accounts of Cleopatra's death. We have Plutarch and we have Dio. Needless to say, one of them is written 100 years after Cleopatra, one of them is written essentially 200 years after Cleopatra dies. Needless to say, they contradict each other in many, many respects. Plutarch is writing closer to the time. He gives us the story of Cleopatra, who knows the end is near. She's been defeated at Actium. She knows Octavian, her nemesis, is coming to Alexandria. essentially to settle his score. Mark Antony has already killed himself. She's backed into a corner. The only option is to be taken prisoner or to kill herself. So how to do it in a locked room with two other women? So according to Plutarch, she readies herself for her death. She dresses herself splendidly, arrives a basket of figs, and in the basket is a snake, which later becomes several snakes. But at that moment, it's only one snake, which Plutarch says is quite possibly the instrument of death. However, he's not sure. The earlier account, in fact, there's an account of Strabo, who is in Alexandria, I think, 4 years after Cleopatra's death, who also says the account of her death is uncertain. No one knows. The no one knows somehow got lost in history because the snake is such a compelling, a snake and a woman. I mean, how much better does it get, right? You've got Eve, you've got Medusa, you've got Electra, and you've got Cleopatra. I mean, a woman and a snake, it's just primal. So, A. B, it's really convenient to be killed by the emblem of your country. I mean, the snake is so central to all symbolism of Egypt. Cleopatra has associated herself with the goddess Isis. There are snakes always often entwined with Isis statuary. It makes such incredible iconographical sense for her to have used a snake. But if you think about it for a second, and perhaps I'm out on a limb here, Cleopatra's in a room with two other women, and they need to die, and they want to die quickly and painlessly. Are you really going to entrust your fate to a wild animal? And this is a woman who makes crisp, meticulous decisions. What if he doesn't bite? What if he doesn't bite all three of you? And also, apparently, only because I've done my research, that kind of a snake is a big snake. When he puffs himself up, he's not going to fit in a basket of figs. I mean, the basket is too small, and the job is too big. Moreover, it seems, if you want to die painlessly, you don't do it by asp, because that's a very convulsive, painful death. And indeed, according to Plutarch, Cleopatra dies a very sort of narcotic, quiet death, which would indicate that something else, some other kind of poison, was probably involved. And to that, I just want to add that every Hellenistic sovereign, if he knew one thing, he knew his poisons. It was like the first item on your school agenda. Know your poisons. And when Cleopatra's uncle, who also has a problem with Rome, finds himself cornered by the Romans decades earlier, he knows precisely what to take to kill himself. I mean, Socrates knew what to take to kill himself. It was not a difficult, this was a subject she would have passed with flying colors. So I don't really buy the snake. It seems to me as if it's a little too convenient iconographically, and it's a little too inconvenient practically. But I do write the possibility into the book, and the way I solved the problem of the death was essentially to give you both accounts. And the other possibility, of course, is that Octavian essentially arranges for her to kill herself because it's very convenient for him to have her just get rid of her, to eliminate herself, rather than for him to have to do the dirty deed, because it's a woman, and it's complicated from his point of view as to what to do with this very, still very popular, still very powerful prisoner. Sorry about the snake.
Gentleman right here in the third row.
I wanted to ask, you weren't originally trained as a historian. You were an editor, I believe.
I was trained to be able to read philosophy.
Okay. So I remembered that Anthony Lewis wanted to write about the Supreme Court and a criminal case. He went to Harvard. And so I'm wondering, when you started this project, or as you began to think, well, I might do this project, what kind of things did you do? You allude to one thing, which is you say there was kind of an accepted curriculum of things that everybody would learn if they had a Greek tutor. And so you could kind of undergo some of that yourself, read the same books they were reading, maybe in translation. Were there other things like that that you did? Did you take a crash course? Did you make a lot of friends with historians so you could pick their brains as to what methodologies they use?
I don't normally resort to brain picking, but in this case I did, partly because Cleopatra falls in a crevice of one kind. You need an Egyptologist on one side of you, you need a Hellenistic historian on the other side of you. And interestingly, I would say to, you know, a great Hellenistic historian, well, do we know if the Ptolemies were cremated or if they were mummified? You know, did they subscribe to Egyptian burial rites or Greek burial rites? And they'd say, ask an Egyptologist, I don't know. And, you know, there's a real divide there to some extent. What I did, indeed, as my sort of master's degree in the subject was to read everything she would have read. The way I started was, we know she would have read Herodotus, Thucydides, you know, the major playwrights, Aesop's Fables. I started with what I assumed she would have known, and when I hit a rough patch in terms of questions, I relied largely on Roger Bagnall, who's a great Hellenistic historian, for things like if you're exiled in the desert and you need to get to Caesar and you need to get past enemy lines to get there and the tide is against you, how do you do it? And he looked at me like I was insane because he'd never thought about that before. So I think in a funny way, I just asked stupid questions. Anyway, the more we thought about it and the more I plied other people with that question, it seems that what you do is you go south and then north again, up and down the Nile, in other words, to get west, because the tide would be in the reverse direction. But the answer to your question is no, I still hope to go back to school and get a PhD. I just haven't decided in what field yet to do so. I'm taking suggestions, though.
You know, Stacy, since we're in the library, I thought I'd ask you about the library in Alexandria and how that burned. I know you mentioned it early on in the book, and it was possibly the result of Caesar sinking the ships, but I wonder if you can elaborate on it.
That's another one of those, the great unknowns. You know, what happened, where's Jimmy Hoffa, and what happened to the Alexandrian Library? We don't really know. I mean, by some accounts, and again, this is the problem with Caesar's marvelous memoir, it elides more than it tells. I mean, it's a sort of a memoir without a personality in many ways, and it doesn't mention things like crossing the Rubicon or what happened to the library. So it is certain that during the Alexandrian War, during this moment when Cleopatra and her brother are at war with Caesar supporting Cleopatra, some damage is done to at least the stockyards for the library where the documents are stored, and possibly to the library itself. It's unclear. No one ever wants to really claim credit for it. Later writers do seem to indicate that there is still a library in Alexandria. Of what proportion, we don't know. So it remains, there's a lot written on the subject, and it remains a real question mark as to how much does Caesar truly destroy and what happens after Cleopatra's death to what does remain of her library.
But it was inadvertent on Caesar's part.
Definitely inadvertent. Oops, big mistake. Yeah.
Another question, right here in front.
Just what did happen to her children, and how many fathers were involved?
I'm sorry, what was the second part? How many fathers were involved? Oh, what a good question.
And what happened to them?
She has one child with Caesar. Cleopatra has a remarkable ability to have children at very opportune times. And I do spend a certain amount of time talking about birth control in the first century BC, a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I mean, some of these things we know today actually had some sort of efficacy. And some of these things were remotely effective. Who knows? But in any case, she has one child, and it is conveniently a son with Caesar, who comes, in fact, to resemble Caesar a great deal, and whom her people refer to as Caesarian, as in little Caesar. This is, in a funny way, the thing that cements her alliance with Caesar and the thing that will spell her doom, because once Octavian posthumously becomes Caesar's heir, he cannot coexist in a world with this other, there are too many Caesars, with this other son. That is the eldest child. After Caesar's death, she has three more children with Mark Antony, a set of twins, also at a very opportune time, and later, 2 years later, another son. Before her death, she realizes, as Octavian is closing in on her, that Caesarion has to leave, that somehow spiriting Caesarion out of the country is necessary, and she tries to send him off, probably to India, unsuccessfully, because he is, in fact, murdered in the end by Octavian's men. The three other children, bizarrely, the children by Mark Antony, are taken back to Rome, and they are raised by Octavian's sister, Octavia, who in fact was Mark Antony's previous wife, or Mark Antony's wife, who had a big household with a number of other children by other marriages, and who apparently raises them in great comfort, despite the fact that those children reportedly walk in the triumph, in Octavian's triumph over Egypt. The two brothers, we lose all track of at that point. The sister, who is one of the two twins, Cleopatra Selene, marries an African king and basically establishes a court in Mauritania that very much corresponded to her mother's court, a very cultivated court. She has a library. She continues the Isis association. She puts herself on coins. She uses Greek. It's a sort of a miniature Alexandria. And she has a son who will ascend to the throne in turn and who will be murdered later in Rome by Caligula. And that's the end of the line so far as we know it. Although there's a wonderful rumor that Cleopatra was Christ's grandmother. I always wanted to work that in and I never could figure out a way to fit it in.
Gentleman in the third row here.
Thank you. I majored in Roman history at the University of at Temple and taught at the University of Cincinnati after my degree. So I'm right there where you are. I read the sources, Dio and Plutarch and Suetonius. I mean, I understand what you mean by that you were recontextualizing her. The resource context, the first, you know, the primary sources are what we really have to go by. So it's like really interesting to read what you've reconfigured. My question, which a friend of mine asked, is that we've already discussed Caesar and we already discussed Mark Antony and her relationship. Do you think that had things happened differently, that Cleopatra might have done the duty to Octavian? You know what I'm saying here? I mean, if she did the duty to Caesar, if she got Mark Antony, which was Caesar's lieutenant, could she, within the right circumstances, have been able to be the serpent of the Nile to Octavian? I mean, that's a question that I think it's valid.
It's interesting because at the time that she, at the point Caesar is murdered, Rome erupts into a series. I mean, it's the most confusing set of circumstances to who's going to basically inherit the Caesarian mantle and who's on whose side and who really murdered Caesar. I mean, everyone's suddenly like a member of the French Resistance. Everyone's saying, "I murdered Caesar," and whom to follow and whom to flee is the real question. And Cleopatra is remarkably canny about waiting it out, about kind of giving a little bit of support here, a little bit of support there, but not really coming out on anyone's side. Octavian would have been the least obvious person to follow. He's 18 years old. He has no military experience. He's a callow youth. There's no reason whatsoever to believe at this point that you are talking about a canny political thinker at this point, a major strategist. Had she waited a few more years, she might have figured that out. But Mark Antony seems as if he is so much the obvious horse to back, and moreover, he's in control of the eastern part of the empire, Octavian of the West, so in theory, Cleopatra reports to Antony anyway. There's one other problem, other than the fact that it would have been hard to see at that time where Octavian was heading, because it's so surprising, even that he would win at Actium is so surprising, which is that she has Caesarion. She has a child who cannot coexist with Octavian. You cannot be two sons of Caesar. And when I mentioned this to the aforementioned Roger Bagnall as a problem, he said, "Oh, but then she would have murdered Caesarion," which had never occurred to me. So yes, I mean, I guess yes, she could have. It would have meant getting rid of her child. It would have been, I mean, I'm not big on the ifs in history. I don't really go there. But yeah, I guess it's not impossible. I mean, her strategy was to keep Egypt autonomous. Her strategy was to maintain her hold on the throne and to continue her dynasty. Do I believe she would have done anything to make that happen? Yes, absolutely. What that would entail, I'm not quite ready to speculate about. But we'll talk afterwards.
Lady in the second row here.
Hi there. You know, popular culture tells us that she was, I heard it first, she was European, then I heard she was African. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that.
Sure. Bizarrely, and you know, I think Elizabeth Taylor has made us lose all sight of this as much as Shakespeare or anyone else. Elizabeth Taylor really gets in the way. It's amazing. The Ptolemies are Macedonian Greek. They descend from one of the most enterprising, if not the most enterprising general of Alexander the Great, who helps to subdue Egypt, quickly realizes that Egypt is the jewel in the crown, the most fertile country, and essentially claims it for his own. So he is the founder of, and he is Ptolemy. He is the founder of the Ptolemaic dynasty, from which 300 whatever years later, Cleopatra will descend. That dynasty, for reasons that are unclear to me and seem to be unclear to most historians, intermarries, by which I mean brother and sister marriage, all the way down. So that Cleopatra is the 10th in a series of internal, whatever you want to call them, incestuous marriages. Occasionally, a Persian princess seems to have snuck in there, or at least once a Persian princess seems to have turned up. Otherwise, because they marry family members, they are 1,000% Macedonian Greek. So I don't really see any question ethnically as to who she was. An interesting byproduct of that is that because you are marrying taught marrying sisters all the way down the line, the woman becomes much more important. It's not whose child, it's not the child whom the man has that's important, it's the child whom the woman has that's important, which is in a funny way how Cleopatra gets away with what she gets away with. Yes, it's Julius Caesar's child, but it doesn't matter. The mother is the Ptolemy. So it puts this enormous emphasis on the Ptolemaic princess, and it gives her a lot more value than she might otherwise have had. In addition to which, as I mentioned, women in Cleopatra's day in the first century BC have these uncanny and extraordinary rights in society. So there's this huge emphasis on women and on women in power, and not the allergy to it that the Roman world would have brought to the scene.
We have time for a few more questions. A gentleman here on our left in the fourth row.
You know, in the movie Cleopatra, they had quite a long sequence on the Battle of Actium. And I was wondering, did it unfold like that, where they baited Antony and he sees Cleopatra take off and he leaves? And it looked like they actually could have won that thing.
I'm at a slight disadvantage answering your question because, in the name of historical accuracy, I never have watched the movie.
Oh.
However, let me try to answer you by saying no one is really sure what happened at the Battle of Actium. That's another one of those. You know, here you have a major event, which later is made into a turning point in history, a major naval battle, the greatest naval battle for hundreds and hundreds of years. It maybe was just a skirmish. I mean, nobody's entirely sure of how many ships were even involved. If the splendid accounts we have of one side with the two light vessels and the other side with the two heavy vessels, if that's even true. And this is a case, again, as it often happened with the research with this book, of earlier accounts of earlier battles, earlier queens, earlier relationships, have sneaked their way into the classical record, reworked. So that, for example, the story of Cleopatra dissolving the pearl to impress Antony, that story's been told several times before about several other decadent people. And the Battle of Actium sounds resoundingly similar to several earlier battles. So it's hard to say what happened. Cleopatra surely does flee. It seems to have been a prearranged flight, so it wasn't out of cowardice or treachery that she leaves the scene of the battle. Whether Antony is meant to follow her as quickly as he does or in the way he does is unclear. And Plutarch's account of him then sitting on Cleopatra's ship with his head in his hands, you know, sort of, what have I done? You know, I've brought shame upon myself. Well, first of all, that could be invented on Plutarch's part. But if it were true, then it would indicate that he indeed had not followed the battle plan that the two of them had devised. Clearly, she needed to make a break at that point with her treasure for Egypt. It was clear to them that they had pretty much lost the day, you know, from the get-go, which again is an astonishment that they should have lost at Actium is one of those, you know, just bizarre irregularities in history. What seems unclear is what Antony's battle plan should have been on that day.
Lady about 10 rows back on the left there.
With such a limited amount of primary material, was there ever a time when you thought this biography was really going to be historical fiction?
No, for one very pertinent reason. I have very little imagination. No, there was a time when I thought I would have to structure it differently. There was a time where I thought, there are so many whole things we just can't know, I would write it episodically. I would write only to those pieces that we did know and let them, almost as short stories in a funny way, or short takes, and let those stand in for the whole. And then as I started writing, I realized that there was enough to go on. I mean, the chapters in Rome for me were very instructive in that we really only have three lines of Cicero about Cleopatra's stay in Rome. Somehow, and I'm not quite sure how, those turned to two full chapters for me. I'm not sure what they're about, really. just kidding. I know what they're about. But it became clear to me that, again, using what we did, what we knew of how Rome viewed Cleopatra, using the tremendous amount that's been written recently on Rome in the last couple of decades about Rome and its attitudes toward women and Roman women, and knowing what we would have known about what she needed from Rome, you could actually construct
a perfectly good non-fictional narrative of those times. There are a great number of fictional works about Cleopatra. I've not yet read them, but I'd love to hear at some point if any of them is worth reading, because I'm pretty much ready to now watch the movies.
Is there a periodicity to the interest in Cleopatra? I mean, why Cleopatra?
I like to think it's peaked right now.
Right. Well, that's what I'm wondering. I mean, with the Franklin Institute
I find that whenever I write a book, everyone else writes on the same subject. So I'm not sure I'm starting or someone else, I'm following or I'm leading. But I do think what finally brought me around to this, because I've been writing op-ed columns for a newspaper for a while, was the idea of women in power was really on my mind, and here you have this really compelling example of a woman who is more powerful, with the possible exception of Catherine the Great, more powerful than really most of the women we've ever heard of, and who, until the very last minute, carries it off. She's dealt a losing hand. She loses things. She gets them back together. She loses them again. She puts them together even more splendidly, and then she loses it all. It's an extraordinary story. And to have a woman in that position in any very martial male world was fascinating to me. And I do think that plays somewhat to our obsessions right now. But I don't know. Otherwise, something in the drinking water.
Well, please join me in thanking Stacy Schiff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.